You're listening to a special episode of the Offscript Podcast. My name is Mark Coffin, and I'm one of your hosts. In last week's podcast, we told you about a book called Tragedy in the Commons, Former MPs Speak Out on Canada's Failing Democracy. It was written by Michael McMillan and Alison Lote, co-founders of Samara and two of the voices you heard on last week's podcast. Their book and the research they did partly inspired this podcast, and we wanted to share some of what sparked our interest in interviewing former MLAs. In this special episode, we're sharing an extended version of the interview we did with Alison Lowe for last week's podcast. The other voice you'll hear, aside from Alison's, is Louise Cochran, and Louise has been co-leading this project with me for the past few years. In our interview with Alison, we asked her how exactly they arrived at the idea of an exit interview for former MPs, and what impact her work has had on Canadian politics. So Alison, you wrote the book when you were running an organization called Samara, and I wonder if you can tell us a bit about that organization and let us know what you're doing now.
Sure. Well, Samara was an organization I co-founded in 2009 with Michael McMillan in Toronto, and our goal remains to try and reinvigorate Canadian democracy and improve the connection between citizens and their politics. So that was really the exit interviews that led to Tragedy in the Commons was our first project, and I can talk more about that later. Right now, I am the managing director of another new nonprofit organization called FCLT Global, which stands for Focusing Capital in the Long Term. And we work with businesses and investors to try to increase the long-term horizon in their decision-making, because we hope that if that happens, we'll have more sustainable organizations and a better well-being for citizens around the world.
So as I understand it, the Exit Interview Project was one of the very first or the first project that Samara ever did. What motivated you to do it?
You know, back in the early days of Samara, when Michael and I first met, we shared a concern and a belief that, you know, Canadian democracy could be better. You know, obviously Canada, as we all know, is a wonderful place. And we thought that, you know, we could aspire to a better quality of politics and governance for all of us. Lofty goal, wonderful to hear, but our challenge is how do we actually make that a little bit more concrete? So we spent a long time, frankly, thinking about what our first project would be. Because often, as you would well know, the first thing you do often says, you know, more about you than any words ever would say. So it was frankly a process. We spoke to a lot of different people who've been in politics, outside of politics, in and around public service to get their advice on how we might take the most practical first step. One of the ideas that we had was that it was really the recognition that a lot of elected officials, when they first come into office, are not particularly well supported. There's very little orientation. I think one of the great strengths of our system is the diversity, actually, of people who do run for public office in terms of their background. We don't have a sort of political class, so to speak. I mean, there are individuals who spent their lives in politics, but most elected officials have not. So in many ways, it's a massive career transition, very unsupported. So we were thinking about doing something to help provide executive support and executive education, for lack of a better word, to elected officials. And in the process of kind of thinking through that, somebody said, well, do we actually know what elected officials want and think? Like, has anyone ever asked them? And so that led us to say, actually, it might be useful to try to do that. We then realized that current sitting elected officials are busy, they're constrained by political demands, partisan demands, and the like, and frankly haven't had that space to reflect on what that experience was and how it could be better. And so that led us to the idea of an exit interview, which, you know, as you have articulated, is very common in other organizations, private and public, and a way to collect best practice and perspective on how an organization can improve. And we thought it was kind of a sad comment that they had never been done. And, you know, what we argue is one of the most important workplaces in the country, our parliament. And so we set out to do that. So I'll pause there and I can talk a lot more about the sort of nuts and bolts of that if it's of interest.
I guess I'm curious where, at the personal level, we were talking a bit earlier about how the amount of work that goes into coding and analyzing all of the hours of recordings that you get from doing a project like this, how much work that takes, and we're kind of on the tail end of doing that now. What was the motivating factor for you personally when you were kind of deep in this work? Why did it matter to you at an individual level?
I mean, mean, starting Samara, frankly, it's hard to separate, you know, me as an individual from the project from Samara, because frankly, they were also intertwined. I certainly wouldn't have started Samara unless I, you know, believed and cared very deeply about, you know, the country I feel fortunate to be born in, and a belief that it was possible to make things better. So, you know, for me, I felt even the opportunity to, you know, frankly, get paid to be able to start an organization that was concerned with those issues was, you know, it's a singular and immense privilege. And so for me, I was trying to think, you know, how do I personally, as someone who, you know, cares, but I'm a pretty normal, you know, unremarkable person, you know, how do I do right by this? And, you know, one thing I know in this world is that I don't think we listen enough to the people who have that frontline experience, which I most certainly did not have. You know, I have, you know, I helped out with some campaigns here and there, but I've never been an elected official. And I can't pretend, you know, notwithstanding my 2 degrees in politics, to, you know, truly know what that is like. So I have to admit, you know, my sort of intellectual curiosity was quite piqued by the opportunity just to have a chance to sit and talk and hear from these people. And I also thought it, frankly, it was kind of a clever way to get us started. It was a national project. It brought forward some perspective and ideas that I don't think had been systematically collected and included. So I saw some opportunity for impact there, which was exciting. And I also just thought it frankly would be fun. And if you, you know, they always say if you find a job that's fun, you don't have to work a day in your life. So that was great. But you know, as I got into it, you know, you uncover other unexpectedly wonderful things. I mean, one is we made a decision to actually travel to the MPs themselves and to the extent possible do the interviews in person. And most MPs retire back to their communities. And, you know, for many, they truly retire. It's their last job. And so they're, you know, they don't have an office to go to. So very often we found ourselves in, you know, the living rooms and the kitchen tables of you know, really a snapshot of Canada. So I got to go along with Michael. I mean, we did the interview separately. We kind of split up the country. But, you know, between the two of us, we saw, you know, many nooks and crannies that I certainly would never have had an opportunity to see before. So that was very special. You know, and the interviews, they followed we had a sort of set script, but obviously it's a conversation, so it evolves. But we, you know, we had this opportunity again after kind of, usually it took about 10 minutes for someone to warm up. And one of the most common comments we had at the end of an interview was, nobody's asked me these questions before. And so you kind of saw the MP as a, you know, human kind of getting into this reflective mode. And the life is so busy when you're an elected official that the reflection isn't really something that a lot of them have a chance to do. You know, even after they've left, then they're like, oh, that's behind me and on with the next. So to just be able to, you know, frankly, have the privilege of hearing that, you know, and obviously being able to reflect it back into reports and books and educational materials, again, just, you know, a singular privilege, really, to be able to do it.
Do you remember what it was like going into your very first exit interview?
I do. I mean, interesting. It was in October 2009. And this was one that was uncommon in that I was interviewing somebody her name is Patty Torsney, and she had been elected when she was about 30. So she'd been in office for, you know, 10 or 12 years, but she was still like kind of in her early mid career when I interviewed her. So she actually had worked, even though she's from Burlington, she worked down on the street basically for me in Toronto. So we met in the Samara offices, and that was the only one that was done in the Samara offices. So I remember it very well. And, you know, frankly, part of it was that she's a wonderful person, warm, friendly, interesting. She had, you know, been elected as a very young woman. And she had grown up in politics and, you know, all of that entailed. So, you know, her story was one of, you know, the public impact that she aimed to have, but also, you know, her own professional path. You know, and there were some lessons that she shared there that, you know, I actually still remember because I think they're useful for life. She was a Liberal, so Jean Chrétien was prime minister for, you know, most, if not all of her time. And he was really, as she said, very supportive of young MPs and actually encouraged them to go and get a diversity of experience. And it makes sense because he had been the minister of many things. And so his point is, you know, every department is different. It's a different organization. And you also need to spend, you know, at least one or two periods of time a year abroad. Because you need to learn how all these different pieces work and fit together to be a truly effective public leader. And I think, you know, no matter what kind of organization you're in, that's an important thing to think about. I mean, getting that kind of cross-functional, cross disciplinary experience, I think, is just an important thing to seek out in life. And so, you know, there's lessons, you know, I took out of that, as well as kind of interesting observations of what does it take for someone to be very successful in Canadian politics. There were other things I was worrying about, like, are these the right set of questions? Are they flowing properly? I mean, it was we had spent quite a long time actually developing the interview guide. We asked each MP for 2 hours, and you're asking somebody to talk about their life in 2 hours. It's not a lot of time. You have to make, decisions about what you think is going to be interesting and what you want them to talk about. And, and frankly, we had some hypotheses of topics we thought would be interesting that went nowhere, as I shared with you. Part of my, I'm listening to her story, but part of me was also thinking structurally, but are we setting this up the right way?
And so what were your expectations going into the interviews, and how did your perception of, I guess, MPs and the wider political system in Canada change?
So my expectations were, I frankly had a bit of nervousness because there's a leap of faith in this project. And, it wasn't, there was a significant investment we were making organizationally in doing it, both in terms of time, but also just the resources and the travel. And so, I frankly was nervous because, you make a bet and you hope it's going to work, but you don't always know if it will. So there were interesting things along the way that we partnered with the Canadian Association of Former Parliamentarians, and some folks there advised us we'd be lucky to get 5 or 7 people to talk to us. So, we cast a wide net, and then, everybody wants to talk to us. So I have to admit I had some nervousness and, apprehension, just didn't want to make, mess it up, frankly. How did it change? I mean, I think, frankly, I felt, you feel a little bit nervous going into a stranger's house anyway, never mind somebody who's, who's been a parliamentarian, but you realize quite quickly, I mean, most elected officials are successful because they're good people. And so they do have a way of making one feel comfortable. And I think, again, when we watch people arguing on TV and acting foolish, we forget that actually most of them are actually really nice human beings and good, really good people. You kind of quickly remember that. And I also think, frankly, some of the, I mentioned this before, but the diversity of the kinds of people who run for office is really a remarkable thing. And so there was I think I probably had a greater appreciation of like the tapestry that goes into, that House of Commons. We think it's all a bunch of lawyers, and, most people we interviewed were sort of teachers, social workers, small business men or women. They were highly local in their backgrounds and interests. So for, somebody, I grew up in Ontario and I was living in Toronto at the time. I don't get to go to, small towns in Alberta very frequently or anywhere else. So to just have that sort of stitching of the country, at least in my own, through those interviews, was really unique. I went to see, for example, one MP called John Efford, who'd been very active in provincial politics in Newfoundland. So everybody in Newfoundland will know him. And he says, Allison, just meet me at the Tim Hortons. So I'm like, okay. So I'm Googling like Tim Hortons, Newfoundland, right? And I call him back and like, there's several, which one did you mean? And it was just great. I kind of hit this dead road and I'm like, where am I going? My cell phone's not working. And then sure enough, there's a Tim Hortons there. And he was there with his truck and, he took me to his home and showed me, the investments in the community that he had built over all the years. And he was just, a fascinating character, as anyone from Newfoundland will tell you, who knows him. So just experiences like that, they're not something I would get every day in central Canada. So I was grateful for sort of broadening and the breadth of the understanding of the country I received as a result of doing these. And again, something, I think the book touches on, but, just due to the constraints of the length, there's 20,000 more stories that can be told for sure.
So you mentioned earlier that it took about 10 minutes for MPs to kind of warm up to you and start talking a bit more openly. Was it true across the board that in an exit interview, people are honest and raw, at least more so than they'd be on the campaign trail?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I think our decision to visit them was also something that, made people comfortable right from the get-go. I mean, they weren't in a television studio. They weren't, so all that kind of helps wash away some of that, regulating your speech that sometimes does happen in public. I was trying to think about it. I don't think I had any that were difficult at all. But we did have a few people who turned us down for sure. Not a lot, but there were some. And the reasons for that, I'd say, were twofold. There were some that just frankly said, that was a time in my life that's gone and in the past. And, you know, I just don't think they wanted to revisit it. So perhaps that would have been an uncomfortable conversation had they agreed to it. So I guess my point here is they all agreed to speak, so they wanted to speak, or else they wouldn't have agreed to. And then the second reason were people who said, you know, I'm not a former yet. I want to run again, either in a similar role or in another part of the country. So I just don't consider myself a former. So if it doesn't work out in 5 years, call me back kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think we were predisposed to meeting with people who were willing to speak, or else they wouldn't have accepted our invitation.
Right. That's interesting. We had, I would say, there's probably three types that we encountered in Nova Scotia. They kind of perhaps didn't necessarily trust us and what we were up to. We're looking for our agenda. And then two, people who said, you know, I don't do politics anymore. That stuff's behind me, like you heard as well. And there's a few people who, Louise and I were talking about this yesterday, who in 2009 in Nova Scotia, four or five people were actually facing criminal charges because of money they had stolen from taxpayers, because the expense system was so poorly monitored in Nova Scotia for MLAs. And I think most have either done jail time or house arrest or both. And, you know, it's a big number in a legislature of like 50 people. Who, you know, close to 10% for of them to go away because of criminal behavior. And yeah, needless to say, they were uninterested in talking to us.
Yeah, fair enough. It reminds me, this is sort of not obviously on topic, but a bunch of years ago, Maclean's had done this cover story on, you know, on how Quebec was the most corrupt province. Mm-hmm. And I was listening to this discussion on one of the radio shows on the CBC, and they had people talking, and one guy from Nova Scotia was like, we were all pretty pissed off because frankly we thought Nova Scotia was the most corrupt province. Anyway, I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's obviously, don't put that on the podcast, but
I hadn't heard that story before. I thought it was kind of funny. So I checked with Allison and she said it was okay if we put it in the podcast.
It's funny that you mentioned that there was like a group of people who refused to do interviews who wanted to run for office again, because we interviewed Gary Burrell, who's actually currently like the leader of the Nova Scotia NDP. Like, he lost a seat in 2013 and he's like a leader without a seat. But he was very candid. Like, I was very surprised because when we interviewed him, he was actually in the middle of his leadership campaign to when he was running for the leadership of the provincial NDP. So he was kind of a unique guy. But.
Yeah, and there were certainly some that were running again that were happy to talk to us. So it was really just a few that fell into that camp for us.
And it's also interesting that you mentioned that the MPs that you interviewed were more kind of candid. Is you're like in a comfortable place with them, like their living rooms? Because Mark and I, like, we, you know, due to kind of budget limits, we interviewed a lot of the MLAs when they were kind of in Halifax on other business, but we did go to some people's houses and we found that, you know, Mark says this is a mix of being, you know, Nova Scotian and also being kind of older and but a lot of the MLAs we spoke to were like, they told us perhaps like too much, like they were they kind of rambled a bit because we were just like in an informal kind of very casual setting.
So I know we're reaching the time we promised to let you go by, but there's one question I wanted to put to you that I thought might be interesting to ask before we let you go. So Tragedy and Commons came out a few years ago. You did the exit interviews many years ago. In the spirit of exit interviews, you've left your job at Samara and you're doing something else now. Looking back on this project, was there anything you would have done differently if you had a chance to do it again?
Yeah, there's things I wonder about. So when we spoke early on about this, I kind of said, you know, it's worth thinking through what your end products are, because that sort of leads. And we, you know, we knew, frankly, one of the big purposes of it was to start an organization. So we were kind of thinking, we'll produce some interesting reports and kind of see how it goes. I might have pushed the 2009 me just to be a little bit more thorough on, I mean, we had lots of different ideas for things, but just really, what is this for? So, you know, decision, like, for example, this has been translated into, you know, high school textbooks, and the book is used on university curriculum, but, you know, could we have been a little bit more explicit about the educational piece of it, you know, and maybe we could have talked to some people in advance and kind of set that up. So that, there's things like that where, I mean, I think we had great reach. I was very pleased. I think, you know, we have concrete examples of impact, you know, countless people who are thinking about running for office have read the book. I mean, I'm very delighted with the project overall, I should say. So, and Samara is looking to do it again. So that's, you know, on the whole, I'm delighted about it. So if I were to sort of, but I would sort of look back, and so that would be one thing. You know, people learn through stories, and I think these MP stories can actually be really valuable tools for younger people to, you know, better understand and appreciate, relate to the people who are in politics. We did think about things like podcasts, but we didn't do it. And again, I think that there could have been a good opportunity there. So that's why I'm so excited that you guys are doing them. That's really excellent and much needed. We intentionally didn't videotape people for the reasons I mentioned about ensuring that we have a comfortable conversation and they don't feel it's a performance interview. You know, but maybe we could have gone back and done a couple of interviews by video, just things that went to increase the reach. I think, you know, one more, you know, we thought a lot about it, but just one more level of specificity and kind of objective for us might have been good, but it's easy to say that in retrospect when it was successful. So that's the thing. I mean, then there's other things that I don't think they could have been avoided. You know, but things that really had to do with the kinds of questions that we asked. So there were subjects that we were, you know, really careful to avoid. So for example, we didn't want to, you know, ask people about their families for reasons of privacy. You know, we also wanted to ask questions of people that were uniform across all the groups. So we didn't spend a lot of time, you know, talking to women about their particular issues or immigrants or, you know, that. So, you know, again, like more questions like that, you know, could have elicited, you know, even a deeper understanding. But again, you know, you have to make decisions in 2 hours, which you can do. But things like that, I also thought, I might have just pushed a little more on some of the personal things, because frankly, people did want to bring that up and talk to them. Like a lot of people would articulate their biggest successes as being the first of something, you know, the first MP of this background, the first MP from this area, the first woman to do that, the first man to do this. So that meant a lot to people. And I think we probably could have pulled more out and talk and encourage them to talk more about that. The reason we didn't is because we were trying to, you know, sort of treat everyone the same. And so questions that, you know, only spoke to a portion of it. But I think that was a bit of a lost opportunity, if I were to look back critically. I also wondered if there's more we could have done on the cabinet minister versus backbencher distinction. That's another example of, you know, where we knew going in that people were going to have different perspectives, but we were trying to really talk about their experience as an MP. So more on just how government works and those in government could have been, you know, again, a little more interesting to dig into. And I think, again, people wanted to talk about that. Few things, again, I think some of that stuff I mentioned would have actually made for some great chapters in the book. We just didn't have the material.
You've alluded to it a few times. You know, you're happy with the book. You're proud of all the impacts that have resulted. Can you talk a bit about what the specific impacts and results are?
I think one of the biggest, you know, impact, what kind of influences it had was on the narratives MPs used to describe themselves. So, you know, in the book and in the first chapter, a couple of chapters in particular, we point out that almost all of them, when we asked them for their background, spent a long time explaining away their interest in politics. So either saying they had never had it, they were asked and weren't expecting to be asked. When they were asked, they didn't want to do it. You know, this real portrait of a reluctant kind of outsider, rather than somebody, you know, we had one person who said, you know what, I thought politics was a great way to contribute, and I was delighted to have the opportunity to do it. You know, that doesn't feel very controversial, but very few, if any, really said it. So it's interesting because since the book has come out, I've had a lot of people approach me and say, I read your book and that's ridiculous. I've always wanted to run for office. I think politics is important. So I think, you know, just to even point out that how they as individual political leaders in their community, their country, articulate the value of what they're doing has a huge influence, not only on how they think about themselves, but on how people perceive them. Because any, you know, person who hears a politician say, oh, I never wanted to do this, says, you know, give me a break, right? And so this actually, the narratives they use actually diminish their profession or their calling in the eyes of the public, which is just so counterproductive. So, you know, I think we need to continue to push for some of those kind of narrative reframings, for example. But, and I think we have to actually call out elected officials to stand up for their profession and themselves and what they do. And I think that's really important and is a huge first step. So I think there's definitely been impact there, and, you know, more to go. And you know, that'll be ongoing. You know, more practically, before we released the book, we released a series of reports that sort of summarized some of the major themes that we released to the media, and they did pretty well in terms of media coverage. So out of that, there were some changes made to the orientation of new MPs because I think the book highlighted the fact that most of the MPs were called having no orientation or training, and sort of wished that they'd had more. So there certainly were efforts made by, you know, people both in parties and also in the parliamentary apparatus, so to speak, to try to, you know, improve that process. So I think that's, you know, that hopefully will continue to grow and continue to have impact.
What changed? Like, and was that on the part of like the House staff, or was it parties who kind of, you know, decided to orient their staff better or their MPs better?
So, I mean, the reason I'm general about this is because no one ever gave us like public credit for it. People just told me privately. So I don't, you know, that's why I'm pretty general in the language, because I can't, you know, no one's going to say like, Alison, thank you. Thanks to Smart. The parties, I just got one comment from one person that they read it and sort of tried to step it up. So, you know, I don't really know what that means. For the parliament people, they made some explicit changes, because one of the other findings in the book was that, you know, the MPs didn't have a uniform understanding of what their job was, and most of them couldn't even define it at all. So they spent some time in 2011 on that, you know, actually, you know, what is the role of an MP? What are the kind of competing tensions of that job? So kind of a 101, just, you know, I think the assumption is they all know what an MP is when they don't. So that was a tangible thing. I don't know if that's kind of carried forward, but certainly those changes were made. There were a couple of others I forget, but again, it was like one of the women in the meetings kind of whispered to me that like, hey, this is happening. Like, it wasn't, you know, anything public credit, because of course that's embarrassing for Parliament to admit that they haven't been doing this well for all these years. So they don't want to say it. I mean, I still think it remains a challenge, you know, and part of it is just like praise practical, right? You know, like the US actually, they have a transition period. You have a defined time when you know you're running and when you start. And so you can actually schedule things. Like in the Canadian system, in the parliamentary system, it did sort of have that structure. So, you know, I understand there's practical challenges to doing it. There's also, I mean, I did a lot of actually research into orientation of MPs that we never used, but there is, you know, real legitimate, there have been efforts made, fits and starts over the years, like dating back to the 70s that I researched. But there are real tensions between what people think MPs need to know, particularly between what a political party thinks the MP needs to know, a House leader thinks the MP needs to know, and the Parliament, you know, officials think an MP needs to know. And so if you're sort of saying, okay, we have 2 days, what's the agenda? Conflict often emerges. There's also debates, like some elected officials, some parties don't want their people with people from the same parties, and there's a bunch of junk like that. So from other parties, I mean, so, you know, there's reasons why it's been just not that effective, but I don't think that's an adequate excuse for it to continue to be kind of ineffective, but just to recognize that context. Likewise, other players came in and tried to offer some complimentary things. You know, for example, Carleton had a sort of new weekend for new MPs, things like that. I think all of that, you know, certainly helps. You know, other people have said that before, but I think the book kind of propelled that, gave it a little bit of momentum. And then the last thing I think is really just the individual impact that, you know, things that are often most poignant are the things that are personal for people you meet. So, you know, for me, it's really been, you know, meeting people who are interested in politics or are contemplating politics or who've read the book and give it to someone else who they think will be influenced by it. And so I hope it has helped people think through what it takes to be successful and effective in public life and encourages people to pursue it because it's so critical. So I think about the impact on a bunch of different levels. And as I said at the beginning, I mean, it's just was sort of a singular privilege to be a part of this project. So I'm really delighted that you've continued to carry it forward in Nova Scotia.
Yeah, well, we were kind of delighted to have something to kind of pick up on and not have to reinvent what seems to be a great wheel. So thank you. That was our interview with Alison Lote, the former executive director of Samara Canada and co-author with Michael McMillan of the book Tragedy in the Commons, Former Members of Parliament Speak Out on Canada's Failing Democracy. You can get that book from Samara's website at samaracanada.com. We're also putting a link in the description for the podcast that you can follow and purchase it from Amazon. If you want to hear more about what Michael and Allison found, you can actually go to the other special episode for this week, which is a keynote address that Michael delivered in Halifax a couple of years ago at the Better Politics Awards, where he unpacks really the main findings of their work. Don't forget to subscribe to Offscript in iTunes and go to offscript.ca to stream the podcast or find shareable versions of our productions to share with your friends.